Good morning.
Good morning.
Before I start my talk, I just want to acknowledge that this is Father's Day. So I want to dedicate our morning here together to all fathers, past, present, and future, throughout space and time. Fathers. Going to talk this morning from the... Can you hear me back there? Is that okay?
Okay.
A little bit louder? Okay. My voice softens a lot, so just do this if you need it, and I may or may not see you and change it. I'm going to be talking... we've been reading the Bendawa for study group lately, and it's... It's an old friend of mine. I've liked it for a long time. And I was rereading it in preparation for the study group. And I was reading the introduction, which was written by Shahaku Okamura, who was the interim abbot here after our founding abbot died. And it's a really terrific introduction. So if you're reading the Bendawa and you're the kind of person who skips introductions to books, hi, Carl. Hello. Speaking of old friends, so if you're the kind of person who skips introductions, don't skip this one. It's really wonderful. So I was reading it, and this one line or a little section of it jumped out at me, probably because it talks about vow, and I've been thinking about vow a lot this spring because I knew that I had 3 weekends of vow in June, and yesterday was the last day of the 3 weekends. I 2 weeks ago, I went to a Shuso ceremony. Shuso ceremony is a ceremony, it's a Zen ceremony, in which someone who's been a priest for a while is sort of presented to the Sangha, to the community, and there's a bunch of sort of formal ritual, and the heart of the ceremony is when the Shuso reads a koan, and then the members of the audience ask questions about it, and they just answer the questions with whatever comes up, and it's this really wonderful ceremony. So I went to Susan Nelson Shuso ceremony 2 weeks ago at Hokyoji Monastery in southeastern Minnesota. And then last weekend, my husband and I went out to South Dakota for my cousin's wedding. And then yesterday, I was down in northeastern Iowa at Rumanji, another Zen monastery, for another Shuso ceremony for my friend Edo Brusespi. So it's been kind of a month of ceremonies and vows. So I've been thinking about that. And so this little section of the introduction really jumped out at me. And I printed it on the bulletin. It says, each action, each moment of sitting is arousing Bodhi mind, the mind, the heart mind of enlightenment. So each action, each moment of sitting is arousing the mind of enlightenment, practice, awakening, and nirvana. Each moment is perfect, and yet within this perfect moment we have a direction. Direction is bodhisattva vow. So that was the line that that grabbed me. And, you know, he starts out by saying each action, each moment of sitting. So every time we sit down in zazen, we take a kind of a vow. We sit down with the intention of just sitting here, and we take an intention of returning to this present moment. And one of the things that Dogen Zenji, the author of Bendawa, stresses is that when we sit down in zazen, we are taking the vow to fully become Buddha right in that moment, to express enlightenment, to be enlightenment, not only for ourselves and by ourselves, but with everybody. And it's one of those sort of inconceivable, impossible to grasp things. But if you sit long enough and you have a regular zazen practice, somehow it seeps into you. And if you remind yourself enough by reading things like Bendoa and studying and being in a group of other people who talk about these things and point them out to you when you forget, you notice it and you experience it in zazen. So we take this vow to arouse that mind of enlightenment, that Bodhi mind, to become Buddha. And in so doing, we awaken ourselves and we awaken all beings, because we're part of this huge, this metaphor of Indra's net. We're part of Indra's net. And the metaphor is that the universe is made up of this huge net, and all the beings within that universe are a tiny gem at the intersection, at each intersection of the net, and we all reflect back to each other. Not just us, but the grasses, the trees, the mountains, the rivers, all the myriad dharmas are gems within Indra's net. So we awaken ourselves when we sit in zazen. So on page 36 of this, Dogen talks about that. He says, he's talking about in zazen. In zazen, extensive Buddha work and profound, subtle Buddha influence are carried out. The grass, trees, and earth affected by this functioning together radiate great brilliance and expound the deep, wondrous Dharma endlessly. We should think about that every time before we sit down. The grass, trees, and earth affected by this functioning together radiate great brilliance and expound the deep, wondrous Dharma endlessly. And he goes on to say that they demonstrate it and exalt it for the sake of all living beings, and we demonstrate it and exalt it for the grasses and all other living beings. And it goes on and on and on. Then he says, the realm of self-awakening and awakening others is fundamentally endowed with the quality of enlightenment, lacking nothing, and allows the enlightenment to be actualized ceaselessly. So that's what we're up to in zazen, believe it or not. Sometimes we notice that. So, you know, as we sit in zazen, we're actually actualizing enlightenment. You know, our own, for all the beings, all the grass, the trees, the earth. That's our vow. You know, and we're not. So when we say that we're not, that we sit in zazen, and we're not trying to attain anything, we actually aren't. We are actualizing it. We're embodying it. We're doing it. It's happening right there. So that's the intention or the vow that we have when we sit in zazen. And we also, in his quote, he talks about the direction being the bodhisattva vows. So in our lives, we have these vows, too. And there's some vows that we formally take. Sometimes we have all kinds of vows in our lives. The bodhisattva vows are vows that we take. Some of us take formally in ceremonies like Zen initiation and priest ordination. We take these vows. We also chant these vows at the end of Dharma talk, so we'll be chanting it later on today. We chant it during our daily services. So if you hang around here long enough and you do this practice with us, even if you aren't the kind of person who stands up in front of everybody and out loud takes vows, they kind of seep in, because you hear them and you say them, and they kind of get under your skin after a while and remind us that's what we're about. That's what we're about, whether we take them in a formal way or not. Some of you may know that the name of this building, of this place, this plot of land and building, along with this being Minnesota Zen Meditation Center, the formal Japanese name of it is Ganshoji, which means living in vow temple. Temple, ji is temple. So Hokyoji is catching the moon temple, Rumanji is Dragon's Gate Temple, and this is Gunshoji, living in Bao Temple. So that tells you something about how important the idea of living in Bao was to our founder, you know, that he named the place that. So that tells you that it was that important to him, and it's really what this place is all about. It's about living in Bao all the time. I just really quickly want to say what the vows are, because a lot of you know this, and for those of you who don't, I'm just going to quickly say what they are and talk a little bit about them. The first one is, beings are numberless, vowing to free them. And this means that there is nobody who is outside my concern. There's nobody who's outside that net of Indra for me. There's nobody who's outside the jurisdiction of my love. And I'm here to help free all beings. When we were out in South Dakota for this wedding, we stopped on the way home and saw my Aunt Doris, who is this wonderful 90-year-old lady, very feisty, very devout. And at one point in the conversation, I don't know how these things come up in conversation, but it did. She said, you know, I love everybody. There is nobody I don't love. Except my next door neighbor. And we all laughed. And then she very hurriedly said, you know, it's not just me. There's a lot of people in town who don't like her. And I like her daughter. So, you know, so like I'm not a bad person. I just don't like my next door neighbor. So these bodhisattva vows are inconceivable. And it's very, I think, easy to say, you know, yes, all beings, all beings. And then there's that pesky next door neighbor. So we need to engage open-heartedly with all beings, and maybe particularly whoever the next door neighbor in our life is. The next one is, delusions are inexhaustible, vowing to end them. You know, we can't see outside ourselves. You know, we have this limited range of vision. I can't see the back of my head, so my range is necessarily limited. And because of that, I'm going to be deluded all the time, no matter what. But we can understand that we have that limitation, and we can do our best to kind of spot and puncture those delusions when we notice them, when they pop up. This is a wonderful thing about being in Sangha. If we don't notice them, somebody else will, and they will let us know. Tim talked last summer in this wonderful talk. We transcribed it and edited it and put it in, I think, the most recent newsletter. Might have been the one before that. But he talked about Dogen's idea of enlightenment. And one of the things that he said was, enlightenment is about learning to be intimate with delusion. For Dogen, Zen practice provides us with the opportunity to shed clear, unwavering light on each of our delusions. So enlightenment doesn't mean that you have ended all delusions. It just means that you're right there with all your delusions, everything else. You see that you have them, and you're just functioning with them. Pesky neighbor and all. The third one, Dharma gates are boundless, vowing to enter them. Every moment is a Dharma gate. Every moment something comes up. Something comes up, just like Shahaku said. Each moment is perfect, and yet within this perfect moment we have a direction. So boundless Dharma gates, moments, perfect moments that arise are just endless. Moment after moment after moment, I vow to enter them with a particular direction, with a particular way of living my vow. You know, I can't say, well, I don't like this particular Dharma gate. I'm not happy with this particular moment, so I'm just going to wait it out. You can do that, I guess, but the results are not so good. That's sometimes how we create these ripples where things go wrong. And the last vow is, Buddha's way is unsurpassable, vowing to become it. Vowing to become it it's not just believe in Buddha's way or agree with it or listen to a Dharma talk about it. It's not even, the vow doesn't even say, it's not just vowing to live my life according to his tenets. It's vowing to become it. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, vowing to become it. So when we sit down in zazen, in every Dharma gate moment, we become that vow over and over and over again. Two weeks ago at Hokyoji, in the first one of these ceremonies that I went to, my Dharma sister, Susan Nelson, was the Shuso. And I saw her do this right there in the Zendo. There were about 33 of us here, there. And I was sitting next to her because I was the last Shuso, and the last Shuso gets to sit next to them and help hold them up while they're doing this. And it was, I was slack-jawed with amazement. I'm sitting there, Susan is right here, and I'm watching her, and I'm just seeing Buddha. There's Buddha right there, just shining out of her totally. Totally. You know? And I've known Susan about 13 years. We were, ordained together almost 6 years ago. We know each other pretty well. Our husbands hang out together. And I have to say, in every moment that we're together, look at her and see Buddha. But I could, if my eyes are really open. You know, but that's one of the reasons that we come together in these ceremonies. And it's one of the wonderful things, I think, about the Shuso ceremony in particular. It's actually the ceremony where her teacher, the teacher, the Shuso's teacher, our abbot Tim Burkett in this case, presents this person and says, I ordained this person a while ago, and they've been teaching and learning and practicing and doing a lot of zazen and living in vow and doing all these retreats, and look, look, everybody, it's the abbot, sort of holding them up and saying, look. And it's our opportunity for somebody that we see every day, and we all look. And if we think about it, if we really looked all the time, we'd see all these Buddhas around us all the time. It's amazing. But there they are. Poof, it's a wonderful thing about ceremony. It makes us stop and think about these things. It makes us see these things. It was the same way yesterday down at Rumanji with at Edo's Shuso ceremony. I met him just a year ago. I had seen him at things, but I met him a year ago when I was down at Rumanji for my... I spent a month in a monastery, both Hokyoji and Rumanji, and he came down. He was sewing his priest robes. He had been ordained, I don't know when, several years ago, but he had switched to having Shokan as his teacher, so he was being sort of reordained. He was sewing his priest robes, which is one of the things that we do. So I was in the monastery, so we didn't talk very... we hardly talked at all. But we sewed together. And I really felt, when you sew with somebody in silence that way, and you're sewing on Buddha's robe, you really get close to them. Anybody who's sewn a raksu, this is a small version of a Buddhist robe, or a big Buddhist robe together, knows how this goes, right? This goes. You get really close to these people, even though you don't talk to them. And I had never met him before, so... and we're sewing. And then there was this, it was a year ago right now, and if you remember, there were huge storms down in Iowa, a lot of rain. So there was this huge storm, and there were floods. And the people who were here and were getting ready to go down to Hokyoji for their week-long retreat couldn't go because there was this giant flood, and Hokyoji got flooded out. And so Edo and Shokan, the abbot, and I were the only ones at Rumanji, and the phones went out, and then the electricity went out. The phones were out for about 2 days. I don't remember how long the electricity was out. And it turned out that we were flooded in at Rumanji, but we didn't know it because we didn't have radio and nobody could call us and tell us, and we didn't try to go anywhere. But if we had, we would have found out that the road to the west had a huge tree fallen over it, and the road to the east had a bridge that had been flooded out. And so there we were together in this monastery, and didn't even know that we were trapped. So that's how I got to know Edo. Part of the Shiso ceremony, after they've answered these questions, is the audience congratulates them and says nice things about them. And that's in some ways harder than answering the questions. You have to sit there and just say thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And when my turn came, I told him, you know, we went through this together last year, and you were magnificent, and today here you are again, you're being magnificent. He was being Buddha. He was also very funny. So these Shuso ceremonies. We have these ceremonies. We all come together. We notice things that we could notice every day if we would just pay attention. So last weekend I went out to South Dakota for a family wedding. My cousin Jean got married. She's 50 years old. It was her first wedding. It was her husband's first wedding. Her 85-year-old father walked her down the aisle. It's this giant family. I come from this giant family. And so there weren't very many of us there. There were only 18 cousins. And there were only 8 aunts and uncles. There are 67 cousins. And you know, before we all started dying, there were something like 25 aunts and uncles or something. But there were 18 of us there, 8 aunts and uncles. Almost all of us were married. 3 of us were priests. My brother Tom is a Catholic priest. My brother Chester is a Catholic priest. I'm a Buddhist priest. So there were all these vows. You know, it was this little town, 85 people, this huge Catholic church holding 200 people, and very, very traditional, probably the most traditional ceremony. Catholics really know how to do ceremony. We had a full mass, we had communion, we had a Dharma talk. My brother gave the Dharma talk. I had never seen this before, although I'd heard about it, the husband and wife took flowers and went over to the altar of the Blessed Virgin and presented flowers at her altar. It was this amazing ceremony. So there we are, you know, and there's just this, it felt like there were 200 people there, and you could just feel all of those years of vow. And you know, sometimes I can't really get my head around this idea of Indra's net and all of us being part of this huge unending constellation. But when I think about my family, I can kind of get my head around it, because it's this big giant family. And it comes together in sort of different ways. You know, every June there's some celebration. The last few have been 50th wedding anniversaries, and then there was my uncle's 80th birthday. This year it was a wedding. So there's this huge Indra's net of a family. It comes together in different ways with different people each time. And each one of us is this individual. You know, I have a really different life here in the city than my cousin, who's now going to live in this little, outside this little town of 85 people. And yet we come in and we shine on each other and we reflect each other. And my little city life doesn't really matter when I'm there. We're just all together. We're just all together. So there's a sort of inconceivable ripple effect of all these people there. And after the wedding, I was driving back to my aunt and uncle's house, about a little over an hour away, with my husband Dave and my mom. And we were driving and we're chatting about the wedding. You know, did you talk to so-and-so? Could you believe how that kid had grown? You know, did you hear so-and-so's going to Mayo? You know, all these little things. And we're driving, And then at some point we noticed, we're driving across the prairie, and then we noticed that there was this amazing sunset, and the clouds were turning pink, and it was just beautiful. And we kind of all got really quiet, all three of us got really quiet in the car. And I don't know if I even know how to describe this. The day, the whole day of being together and seeing these two people who had already lived, you know, a long time, joining together in this vow, just kind of settled on us as we're driving across this huge prairie with this giant sky, and it's just beautiful. And we just got quiet and kind of rested in all of it, in all of it. And it felt like, you know, what was it that he said? The grasses, the trees, and the earth, affected by this functioning together, radiate great brilliance and expound the deep wondrous Dharma endlessly. So the grasses and the church and the incense and the flowers, and we all radiated that whole experience back and forth. On our way home, Dave and my brother Tom and I stopped to see my Uncle Joe, he was married in 1946. He's 94 years old. So he's been married 63 years. And he's a widower now. His wife died in January. Dave and I have been married 28 years. So we're coming up on half as long as they've been married. Half as long. No. And my idea of what the wedding vow is now compared to what it was 28 years ago is so much different. And I found myself wondering, what is this like for Joe? You know, to be married for 63 years. Wonderful marriage, loving marriage. And now Viola's gone. And he's 94 years old, and he has a tumor in his stomach somewhere. And yet this vow is still there, you know. He told us at one point, he said, you know, I'm not long for this world. And he knows it, and we know it, and there's no saying, oh, Joe, you know, you're going to be around for a long time. He's not long for this world. And he's looking forward to being reunited with Viola soon. And that's his belief. And it struck me that these vows that we take, go beyond this lifetime. They go beyond this lifetime. I've felt that way for a long time about my priest vow. You know, where did this come from? It didn't happen on October 23rd, 2003. It wasn't like it wasn't there and it was there. It feels to me like it came from before this lifetime, and it extends beyond this lifetime. And I could see that with Joe. I could see that with Joe. These vows just they just reverberate. So there are other vows that transform us as well, that we take sometimes. There are vows of vengeance and retribution that we take that also have these reverberations. You know, you look at nations and people who are just locked in these wars and these conflicts, and it usually starts with something happening, and then somebody takes this vow of retribution or this vow of vengeance. And look what comes out of that. Nothing good ever comes out of that, ever. What comes out of it is just more hatred and heartache. The Dhammapada says, hatred never has to go. Hatred never ends by hatred, but by love alone is cured. And it's true. It's true. Do you remember, it was a year or two ago, when the gunman went into the Amish schoolhouse and killed a bunch of the kids. Do you remember that? It was a year or two ago, something. And a couple of days later, the Amish elders came forth and said, we forgive him. You know? They just totally forgave him. And it seemed to me like our whole country just got quiet for a minute. You know, just something turned when we heard that. And then there was all this chatter about, how can they do that? Blah, 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 you know. But it was this amazing moment in our country when people just contemplated the idea of forgiveness after something like that happened. And I was thinking about that the other day, and I started thinking, how different things might have been if that had happened on September 3rd, 2001. You know, if right after we saw that happen, then the towers had been hit, if maybe the consciousness of the nation could have just taken a little bit different direction than vengeance and retribution. Just think how different a world we'd be living in right now. You know? I don't know if it would have helped, but it might have. A little bit. So there are all kinds of vows. So be careful what kind of vows you take. Now, sometimes we don't even know we're taking a vow. All of us have got vows in our lives, every one of us. Some of us are the kind of people, like I said before, who stand up in public and say these vows, and others of us don't. Others of us take them quietly to ourselves. Sometimes we know we're taking them, and sometimes we don't. Sometimes it sneaks up on us and we don't realize until years later that we were taking these vows. But we've all got vows in our lives. This week I saw this movie. It's over at the Uptown. It's a wonderful movie. It's called Away We Go. There's a couple who's going to have a baby. And the young man, and there's this wonderful loving couple. And the young man really wants to marry the young woman. And she will have none of it. She just does not want make that vow. And yet there's a scene where they say to each other, I promise I will always stay with you. I promise I will love this baby. I promise, I promise. They go through a number of wonderful promises. And it's a great moment. But he's the stand up in public, vow taking kind of guy, and she is not. So they take this vow together on a trampoline. Lying on a trampoline. It transforms us. It transforms us. Right now, we're doing the sewing. We're sewing raksus for the Zen initiation ceremony this fall. We do these raksus. They're a small version of the Buddha's robe. We sew them together in silence, and we sew them in vow, and with every stitch that we take, we say, I take refuge in Buddha, I take refuge in Dharma, I take refuge in Sangha, and then the people who do that come together and have the ceremony. It's the last Saturday in September. You're all invited. Mark your calendars now. But our first, and it's taught by Tomoe Katagiri, who's the widow of our founder, and she is a national treasure. We are so lucky to have her here in town. She teaches this practice of sewing. And the first week that we were here sewing together, the first thing that we do the first night is we take all the material and bring it up to the altar right here, and we pass it. We hold it three times over the altar like this. And it's this lovely little ritual. And right afterwards, Tomoe told the group, this ritual transforms this material from ordinary material into Buddha's robe. And everyone's... and I was... you know? So... it was like watching, you know, Susan on the Shusoshi. You know, there she is. Suddenly she's Buddha's robe. And she's just this material. that I see all the time. You know, it's by these vows, it's by these rituals, it's by these intentions that we can see it. Now, I knew a guy who sewed Raksu. Oh boy, when was it? Probably, was Aaron in your group? Yeah, so it was, what, 10 years ago or something?
Ten years
in October. How time flies. So he sewed a Raksu, and we always tell people to put it up somewhere high, put it on your altar when you're not wearing it. Well, his altar was low, and he has two dogs. And he came in one day with his Raksu, and he showed it to Tomoy and me, and the dogs had gotten the Raksu, and they were playing with it, because they didn't know it was Buddha's robe. One of them got this corner, the other got this corner, tore the corner right off of it. I think one of the straps came off, you know, and he brought it in, and everybody who had ever spent a whole summer sewing a Raksu gathered around and went, oh no. So we got it fixed and we put it back together, and he explained to his dogs that this is Buddha's robe. You know, but the dogs didn't know. To them it looked like a piece of material, which I guess answers the question whether dogs have Buddha nature once and for all. So, we're transformed. We're transformed. We don't transform ourselves. In a way, the vow transforms us. You know, the intention of sitting down in Zazen. The most important day to do it is the day when you really don't want to do it. The most important of the innumerable beings is the next door neighbor who you don't like, you know. The vow transforms us. The coming together in these rituals and these ceremonies where we hold each other up and look transforms us. And we're affected by each other's vows, by these marriage vows, by these ordination vows. People take Hippocratic oaths. People take vows of sobriety. You know, I'm sure you can come up with lots of different vows that you've taken, or that, you know, there's sort of innumerable vows that we can take. There's implicit vows. There's vows of that we take when we become parents. You know, there's vows of vengeance and retribution. And other people around us receive the merit or suffer the consequences and the pain of the vows that we take in our lives, and the way that we carry out those vows or don't carry them out. So I want to end by rereading what Dogen said about Zazen. In Zazen, extensive Buddha work and profound, subtle Buddha influence are carried out. The grass, trees, and earth affected by this functioning together radiate great brilliance and expound the deep, wondrous Dharma endlessly. The quality of enlightenment, the realm of self-awakening and awakening others, is fundamentally endowed with the quality of enlightenment, lacking nothing, and allows enlightenment to be actualized ceaselessly. So that's what I want to say about Bendoa and living in Bao this morning. And I'll bet there are other people here who can talk about living in Bao too. Does anybody have anything they want to say or want to ask or want to contribute?
I had a couple of things.
Yeah, Tucker.
Yesterday, a couple, had come into the office, and today is their 50th wedding anniversary.
Everybody stop.
And he's also a minister. And his vow to his church has gone so that he retired like a year ago or so, but they haven't been able to find a pastor to run the church. So every month he keeps going, well, this is the month. After this month, I'm going to retire. So that was just, it really impressed me that his vow to help his community to be of service as a minister, to minister to his flock, was carried over, that he couldn't let go.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the other thing that came up was, when you said, where does this come from? I was reminded by Tim's use of Pablo Neruda and his, I'm summoned from the streets, I'm summoned, you know. I just thought, it hit me, so I had to go get a book on Neruda and start reading, so.
Yeah.
But that's what I thought, too, is that we're summoned a lot of times. It's not necessarily that we wake up and where did this, you know, when did I take this vow? It's we're summoned and we just automatically take it.
Yeah.
I remember talking with Tim about, there was something about vows, and I said, well, I'm not really a vow taker. I'm one of those that, I'm going to do it. I don't need to take a vow to do it. I just do it, you know. And it unfolds on me. So, I don't think we had a little bit of time. But it was like, you know, when I got clean, it was like, either I'm going to do this or I'm not. It's not, I'm not going to play with this. It's not a vow. Because vows can be broken. And that's happened in my life where it hurt. And so I'm very careful about the vows I did. And because they are lifelong.
Beyond lifelong. They go beyond your life. I mean, look at that vow of sobriety. Look at the ripple effects that that has. It's way beyond your life. Way beyond. Yeah. Yeah, Will.
Where is the commonality between deep questioning and living in vow?
Oh, the commonality between deep questioning and living in vow.
And I know that's a difficult question, so...
You know, there's questioning and then there's deep questioning. I'm sorry to keep coming back to the marriage vow and the priest vow, but those are the two most important in my life, so I those are the ones that I know the best. But before I met Dave, I just couldn't imagine how somebody could take that kind of a vow. Your whole life? God, you know, I had lots of boyfriends. And they were great, you know. But what? And then somehow, you just know. And I know that's it's a cliche, right? But there's questioning. And there's doubting, and then there's stepping up when the time is right. Tucker talked about the call. Was it the call? The call. There's paying attention and hearing the call and discerning. You know, doing some, is this something I really want to vow?
As you were saying that, a mental image came to my mind of panning for gold.
Panning for gold. There you go.
I know about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I take pre-vows.
Pre-vows.
Yeah. If there's something that I question or doubt, but there's still something that is inspiring or attractive about it, I will say I can't make a commitment to that, but I would like to be able to make a commitment to that at some point. And that, I think that bridges the gap. I mean, because our whole life is a process, is a journey, and I think that commitments are very serious things that you should keep.
Yeah, yeah. So you don't feel quite ready to commit to this yet, so you take this pre-vow. You acknowledge that you're drawn to it. You acknowledge that you're feeling some sort of, not pull, there aren't words for this kind of stuff, but you're acknowledging it and saying, here it is.
Yeah. What's interesting, too, is that I'm only in town about couple days a month, so they don't get here that often. I'm also, I was born and raised a Catholic. And I can't tell you how powerful what you said about your hometown and your brothers and the ceremony, because there, for me, there's something. I'm almost as attracted to the church as I am impelled by it. And it seems like I've spent most of my life, and I'm pretty old, looking for something that I could make a commitment to.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to be able to make a commitment here.
Mm-hmm.
But I know I'm not ready. And I think that your statement, your whole talk today, but your statement that was recognizing and respectful of something that I know is there's a lot there.
Mm-hmm.
I think of Thomas Merton. I mean, you can go on and on. I mean, mm-hmm. I know that there are people who have found something there, as much as I just have a horrible time with it.
Mm-hmm.
But what's interesting is I think you've provided a kind of a stepping stone. So I'd like to do
Well, I think we need to start a group within Minnesota Zen Center of all the Catholics who have come here. There's something about Catholics and Zen. I don't know what it is. There's some attraction. I've noticed that Catholics and also Jews in particular, those two groups, I don't know what it is. But yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Well, I just getting back to the question about deep questioning and vows. I feel personally that deep questioning is part of any serious vow, and continually, not just before you take the vow, but every step of the way, because I think that there are those who resist taking vows, and then there are those who take vows mindlessly and just as a matter of course, or something that's to be expected of them, or and I think it's important that we question why we're taking the vow and why we're staying with the vow continually, to make it something that remains vital.
Yeah. Is there anybody here who's taken a vow, a really important lifelong vow, and never said to themselves, "What did I do? What did I do? Oh my God! If I had had any idea what I was getting into here, I would have run." Has anybody ever not? Oh, thank God! Put your hand down, Will. Were you raising your hand for that? Were you? Oh, that's so wonderful. Let's talk later. Ben, you were going to say something, yeah?
Yeah. I was just, I think I'm just wanting to emphasize something that I think you said that I thought was really beautiful, which is you were talking about looking at Susan and seeing Buddha, which is...
She was like this, right? Right
yeah.
there, right next
and
to me.
And you were talking about how that is just, you were just seeing something that is always there.
Always there.
And the ritual supports your ability to see that. I think that, you know, one way, and this is only one way, and it could be completely refuted to you, Zazen, or everything we do here, is an opportunity to see what's in front of us as that.
It's absolutely.
You know, because what happened, your heart just opened.
Mm-hmm.
You saw how beautiful it was.
Yeah.
And you saw how what she was doing was way beyond her.
Yeah.
And way beyond you.
Yeah.
And way beyond your way of seeing.
And it was exactly her.
Yes.
It was exactly Susan. Nobody else could have done that in that particular way. There's a particularity and a universality about it. Both. Yeah. It was fabulous.
That's why we practice, I guess.
I think so. I think so. Larry, yeah.
I have a couple points. The questioning going along with vowels, I think, is important. Buddhism, I think, one of the things that is important is to not take things on faith in the sense of not believing something towards experience. But I think Buddhism is very strong in that. It's one of the things that we're like about it, not to accept something blindly and sort of experience it directly.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is the vowels, I think, are, I might have read this somewhere, since familiar to me, but they're not, the bodhisattva, the four vowels, when you think about them, and the way they're stated too here, which I like, is it's not, you don't say the many beings are numberless, I vow to save them.
Yeah.
You say many beings are numberless, sentient beings are numberless, vowing to save them. And that's an important distinction, because I don't think you can take these vows. They're almost inconceivable to take as an individual, because
mm-hmm.
self-individual, that, you know, we have this ego, and we go out and attain this, and we do this kind of thing as, you know, a personal thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like you're acting on the whole, and when you say vowing to do that, that emphasizes that you're not doing this as a, you know, this personal self sort of accomplishing this one thing by taking this vow. I guess if you're doing something as part of Indra's net, maybe, which is sort of the whole part of the wholeness.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. That's a really important point. It's one of the things that I really like about this translation of the vows, rather than it being I vow to save them, or I vow to save them is one translation. We say vowing to free them. And it does. It takes that me out of it, you know. And it reminds us that we all do this together. All beings throughout space and time. So not just beings in the Sangha, not just beings who have taken this vow, not just beings who are here in our lives with us, but all beings throughout space and time. Beings including the grasses and the mountains and the lakes and the rivers and the prairies and the sunsets and the neighbors and everybody, all beings.
That's important too, because we don't succeed as individuals. Likewise, if we don't fulfill it, we don't fail as an individual.
Yeah, there's no succeeding or failing in these vows. Yeah. It's a wonderful thing. Yeah.
Considering whether to say this or not.
Oh, go for it. Go for it.
So, sometimes one finds oneself in the position of trying to find an answer to the question, do I take this vow or don't I? Because life's circumstances force that question upon me.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, it was the marriage vow. A woman, a young woman, that I knew very well, and I had started an intimate relationship, and she was pregnant. And so the question was, do we get married or don't we? And of course, at that time, the standard answer to that question was, you get married.
Right now.
Right now.
Yeah.
And that's what we did. And I knew at the time that I was saying the words of the marriage vow, that I wasn't ready. I was not prepared to fulfill the vow. It was only a temporary situation. And we continued our life from there as a married couple for 45 years. We were divorced in December, because I finally found that, yes, I was right. I had not been ready to take that vow at that time.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I can't say that taking the vow was the wrong choice. We raised two fine children. They have had children of their own.
Mm-hmm.
And whether one takes the vow or doesn't take it, there are always consequences, good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly less stressful, at least immediately, if you can take the vow wholeheartedly. But that doesn't necessarily mean it's wrong to take it, even knowing that you can't fulfill it.
They're inconceivable, these vows. They are. Mm-hmm. Inconceivable before, during, and after.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like it.
Mm-hmm.